Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, good morning to you all.
Morning, Joe.
As we begin, we're going to go through the timing and how that's conducted when we're doing the Zoom oral argument. And our marshal is our timekeeper, and she will show you a green sign like this when it's time for you to begin. And then when you have 5 minutes to go, you'll have a 5 minute sign. And then when it's time to stop, you'll have a red stop sign. So the colors will be helpful as well as the words that are written on them. I will help you if you're busy arguing and you don't see the sign, so don't worry about it. I will always let you finish answering a justice's question, but likely not permit you to start on another discussion once the red sign is up. So if you are prepared, then I will call our first case of the morning. Are you both ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. So I will call State versus Savage, and we begin now with Attorney Bice.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sonia Bice, and I represent the state, the petitioner in this case. The state asked this court for two things here. First, Mr. Savage wants to withdraw his plea to violating a provision of the sex offender reporting statute. He says he has an affirmative defense that trial counsel didn't tell him about. Hill v. Lockhart says that he has to show a reasonable probability he would have insisted on going to trial otherwise, and he has to show a likelihood of success of that affirmative defense at trial. Mr. Savage can't do that. He was charged under 30145 sub 4 because he cut off his GPS monitoring device and absconded from supervision, not because he was homeless and couldn't provide an address. He took the plea because he got a sentence offer from the state that was what he wanted and was a fraction of his exposure, not because counsel didn't tell him about Dinkins. The state asked this court to reverse the Court of Appeals on this issue. And second, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded without reviewing the record to see if there were facts on which it could sustain the circuit court's decision, even with its interpretation of Dinkins. And those facts are there. That's a rule that appellate courts are always supposed to follow. And the interpretation of Dinkins that the Court of Appeals said was that pursuant to the language in Dinkins, the registrant must make reasonable attempts to provide the required information. Even if Dinkins applies to a person charged under the subsection that Mr. Savage was charged under, the facts in the record show that he did not make reasonable attempts to provide the required information. The required information here was staying in touch with his agent, and he admitted at the Mockner hearing that he did not do so.
Counsel, I want to ask you about this idea that you also have to show a likelihood of success, on the merits. Suppose for a moment that you have a Mockner hearing, and it's very clear that, and it's found facts by the trial court, that the defendant absolutely would have gone to trial because there was one particular kind of claim of, say, affecting his reputation or something like that, that he didn't want to have affect him in the long run. And it's very clear he would have gone to trial if he had understood that information. But that claim was extraordinarily unlikely to succeed. But you have, as a factual finding, he for sure would have gone to trial and would not have pled because that's what he really cared about, even if it might not have changed anything. How do you fit your analytical framework into something like that?
Well, I think that the question is helpful in the analysis because what Hill v. Lockhart said was just the now not controversial proposition that Strickland applies in a plea withdrawal context. But Hill v. Lockhart distinguished among different kinds of ineffective assistance of claims within a plea withdrawal context. Some are related to the consequences of the conviction. Some are related to, it depends on what my counsel didn't tell me. For example, my counsel didn't tell me the consequences of the conviction, and my counsel or my counsel didn't tell me about this other affirmative defense. So I wanted to zero in on that and answer your question in that context. Hill's language was, for example, where the alleged error of counsel is a failure to advise the defendant of a potential affirmative defense to the crime charged, resolution of prejudice will depend largely on whether the affirmative defense likely would have succeeded at trial. So we're in a narrow category of where you're alleging that counsel didn't tell you about an affirmative defense. And the Supreme Court said in that category, it's going to largely depend on whether that affirmative defense would likely would have succeeded at trial. So I think that answers your question a little, I hope, by saying it largely depends. I think it that gives wiggle room for the courts. It largely depends doesn't mean more than it says. But we are talking about in the context where the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is the failure to tell me about an affirmative defense. That's different than in Lee, which where the failure to, alleged error was the failure to tell about consequences of convictions. And in fact, Hill was a consequences of conviction case. It had to do with parole eligibility, I think, but it still was addressing plea withdrawal context generally for the first time for applying Strickland. So it said, in these cases, you're going to have to show this.
It seems to me, you know, looking through those cases that, you know, you have one question. The question is whether the person would have pled, pled guilty. And the answer to that question certainly, in many cases, would depend upon whether the defense would have some merit, because it would affect one's calculation as to whether they would plead, right? But as I was reading your brief, it sometimes felt like you were setting this up as a totally separate category, as opposed to a relevant factor for the main question about whether he would have pled or not. At least as I read Hill and Lee, they sort of doubled down on the idea that that's the question. Of course, merit's helpful. Of course, it's relevant to the calculation, but it doesn't strike me as a separate factor, nor does that statement from Hill that you're quoting seem like a separate factor. It seems like common sense in the context of whether defense would change whether you plead or not.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that I learned a lot about this case after I submitted the briefs. It's amazing how much you learn preparing for oral arguments. I take your point, and I agree that Lee says the focus is on the decision making of the defendant. That's, I can't get around that language and don't want to. So your point is well taken. I get that. I think it is a factor, as you said, an important factor. The Supreme Court said it largely depends on it. So it's not a mere factor. But yes, whether he would have gone to trial, and Padilla says it has to be it's an objective determination, and it has to be a rational decision. But yes, sir, I agree with that assessment. And to the extent my brief divided it and parsed it into two separate sections, I would amend that at this point.
Thank you.
The first issue, actually, as to whether he could show that he would likely have gone to trial, that's sort of a good transition, because the Mockner hearing in this case, and there was a Mockner hearing, and there were findings of fact, and there were credibility determinations. And it's a little weird because there was a second issue at the Mockner hearing that was not appealed to the Court of Appeals, but the testimony and the record is still there about all of the testimony from trial counsel and the testimony from Mr. Savage. And that sheds light on the question of whether what his decision making was at the time and what was important to him with what he wanted out of the plea. It's repeatedly stated in the Mockner hearing by both Mr. Savage and trial counsel that what was important to him was a sentence that did not exceed his revocation time that he was serving on his when he was revoked on the sentence, and not to have any additional supervision time. Trial counsel testified he was adamant about that. And I'm sorry.
Mr. Counsel, why in your brief, you also just focus on the prejudice argument. And it strikes me that your argument applies equally, if not with some degree of greater clarity, in the failure to show deficient performance, right? If counsel makes a reasonable decision that this defense is not going to be successful because it doesn't look anything like Dinkins, that's a reasonable judgment. We've said that's virtually unassailable. I didn't see you make an explicit argument there, but it seems like your arguments apply, again, with much more force because you don't have to predict anything about whether he would have pled or not. That's the end of the inquiry. Are you arguing, is it also your position that it was not deficient performance?
If I were asked to make an argument about whether it was, I would say it was not deficient performance. Yes, it is, whether it's framed as, you know, Dinkins is there, it means what it means. It interprets 30145 sub 2, and that would apply to defendants who were charged under that subsection. But it means what it means, but it's not applicable to him. Therefore, yes, it would not be deficient performance for the for trial counsel not to raise that. There's, you know, we would like, the state would ask this court to give guidance on the analysis for prejudice in the plea withdrawal context. That's the reason that we're approaching it from a prejudice, because we think the prejudice analysis is a winner too. But yes, that there is clearly no deficient performance. And in fact, I believe that's the way the trial court went.
Justice Bradley, I believe you're on mute.
These pearls of wisdom have to be heard. I note that on page 3, footnote 3, you do, and I say this respectfully, the dance a little bit with regard to what was just being discussed. You say, and I read from that footnote, the circuit court and the court of appeals disagreed on the application of Dinkins to this case. Although the state considers the circuit court's analysis more thoughtful and persuasive, the state takes the position that this case can be resolved in the state's favor without disturbing the holding in Dinkins. And so you go so far in your brief as to embrace the circuit court's conclusion vis-a-vis the court of appeals by saying you find it more thoughtful and persuasive. It seems like here in oral argument, you're becoming more daring.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the circuit court got it right that Dinkins applied, but didn't state the reason the way I would have, which is there's just substantial difference between Savage and Dinkins. It's only in this very vague, like homeless sex offender categorizing that they're similarly situated, because Dinkins interpreted sub 2 of the statute, not sub 4, which is significant because he was charged with violating failure to provide an address within 10 days before leaving prison. That's not what Savage is charged with. Savage was, compliance for Savage did not mean reporting an address 10 days before he left prison. It meant complying with his agent and making phone calls. Dinkins also was a maximum discharge case. There was no DOC supervision there. All of three writings in Dinkins note that the fact that Dinkins was not on DOC supervision was a key fact in the case.
If I may, I think spoke incorrectly that you didn't embrace that position in your brief. You certainly did, talking about the factual differences between Dinkins and this case, which you're doing now. I just found that footnote. I smiled when I saw that footnote. That's all I'll say. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Factual differences.
There's another reason that, and I just would like to finish up on this point, that besides the fact that it was a maximum discharge case where Dinkins was not subject to any DOC supervision at the time, which Savage is, the Dinkins majority said at paragraph 53, this interpretation is unlikely to apply to a large number of registrants because typically they will be under DOC supervision. It almost explicitly, you know, separates these two categories of homeless sex offenders. And leading to my third part, the DOC had no homelessness protocol administrative director when Dinkins was charged. It happened after the Court of Appeals decision in that case, and both the majority and the concurrence in Dinkins noted the significance of the DOC homelessness protocol that was in place and noted that it didn't affect the Dinkins analysis, but it certainly seems to imply that it would affect the analysis here because there was a homelessness protocol in place when Savage was on supervision.
Thank you.
And so I want to ask about the remand piece here and the Scholar analysis. Is it your position that, first of all, just a curious on your take on this. I don't read the Court of Appeals as remanding to do another Mockner hearing. I read the Court of Appeals as remanding to make a new decision, because in essence, the Court of Appeals is deciding that it was an error of law, in the basis they made the decision. And again, whether right or wrong, obviously, that's a different question. But your position that the Court of Appeals could not have, should not have decided the case, or could not have decided the case. In other words, could the Court of Appeals, since they already did a Mockner hearing, just make that decision? Did they err in not doing that, or was their route of remanding it back to the circuit court to try again a mistake?
Okay. If I understand your question correctly, it is where was the error in the circuit in the Court of Appeals that we're asking you to correct?
Just on the procedural, they sent it back. Was that permissible, or was that an error on their part?
That was an error, and here's why. The Court of Appeals can look at the record and say, the circuit court kind of garbled the law on what Dinkins meant. It didn't mean it was impossible. It meant this other thing. But the next step for the Court of Appeals is to look at the Mockner hearing testimony and look at the findings of fact. That's just basic judging. You just do that next. And the problem, I mean, if you look, the Court of Appeals opinion doesn't talk about the findings of fact or the Mockner hearing in its analysis, and it could have. It does talk about findings of fact, but it could have looked in the record, which is another thing that's the job, and in the record at the complaint, record two, the attachment to the complaint says, you know, I understand it's record 210, the notice of requirements to register, and it's what the complaint cites to. I understand that my sex offender registry requirements requires me to stay in touch with my DOC agent. And he acknowledges that he absconded from those two things together means that no matter what Dinkins means, he couldn't. The circuit court was right to deny his plea withdrawal motion.
Right. So you're saying, you know, you've got a Mockery hearing, so you've got facts that are found. Even if the Court of Appeals thought that the trial court got it wrong on the basis for it, the trial court still had the facts from which to render its own decision on the Strickland analysis.
Yes, and not only from the Mockner hearing, but in the record itself. There's, you know, the Mockner hearing does include Savage's admission in his own testimony that he absconded from supervision, that he cut off his GPS monitoring, and that he stopped being in touch with his agent. And the record also includes this document that he signed saying, I know that to comply with the sex offender registry, I have to stay in touch with my agent. And after June 17th, he stopped making any phone calls to anybody and was absconded for 5 months.
Attorney Weiss, I want to ask you a question about the amicus brief that was filed by the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, WACDL. In their brief, it appears to me that they are advocating that we should not, and this is from page 9 of their brief, that we shouldn't have defendants prove in any particular way that the effect of an attorney's mistake on that defendant, but that we should allow any relevant proof to establish the second prong in Strickland, the prejudice prong. I just am wondering what your position is based on the position that WACDL is taking in their amicus brief.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised that I didn't find much to disagree with in WACDL's brief. I don't think the state has argued otherwise as to the what kind of evidence could be submitted. I mean, the fact is, unfortunately for Mr. Savage, there's no evidence except his own post hoc statement that he would not have taken the plea. As opposed to in Lee, where there was lots of corroborating evidence from the plea hearing and from trial counsel saying, yeah, this was the consequences of the conviction were a big, big deal to him. Here was the facts and here's what I told him and so forth. There was all of that corroborating evidence. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with any kind of evidence being brought forward to that. Just it can't be just the post hoc assertion of the defendant.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, because in your brief on page 23, that's what you talk about. You talk about the post hoc. So your position is that you could rely on some post hoc assertions, but it couldn't be all after the fact. Is that what you're saying?
That's, you know, necessary but not sufficient kind of thing. He can, obviously he would say that if it was true, just like Lee did. Hey, I wouldn't have taken this if I'd known what the consequences of the conviction were. But that's not all Lee had. He had all of this other evidence, and state has no objection to that, more evidence. But in Mr. Savage's case, all he has is suddenly and somewhat contradictorily to his own Mockner testimony, I would have not taken this plea. And as the circuit court noted, it looks like you thought you could get the sentence that you wanted. We know from your own testimony what was really important to you in taking this plea. You wanted no more supervision, and you wanted nothing beyond your revocation sentence. We know that. So the circuit court just didn't accept the post hoc assertion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Am I on?
No, not unless she cedes the rest of her time.
Okay, somebody unmuted me, so that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, no. Do you have anything else that you'd like to present to the court, Attorney Bice?
You know, I think I have, unless the court has further questions, I don't have anything further to add.
Okay, very good. Then Attorney Rosen, let's
see. Thank you, Your Honor. Sign.
Good, and you may begin. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of the respondent, appellant George Savage. The one thing I think the state is misconstruing is that the case note agent who submitted Exhibit 1 to the motion hearing, which I attached to the defendant's motion for post-conviction relief, she specifically indicated that the fact that the GPS monitor had been cut off was not something that had something to do with the SROP compliance requirement. She specifically stated it appears he's compliant on SORP registration because he was making those phone calls and trying to get a hold of the agent, and that the DOC, the cutting off of the bracelet had to do with the DOC, that he did not want to intend to stay on supervision with DOC. The state in this matter is sort of mixing these two together, and it's not mixable. And the agent indicated that, and Ms. Dick indicated that at the sentencing hearing, that he was intending to stay compliant on the SORP registration requirement because he was making these phone calls. The trial court didn't even get into the Dinkins issue about the credibility. I mean, Ms. Dick admitted, from my recollection at the Mockner hearing, that she never advised Mr. Savage about this Dinkins issue, and she just brought it up at the sentencing hearing. He had no knowledge of it. I think that's one thing that the state is positioning. Well, you know, there were these pre hoc require statements made in Lee where he wouldn't have taken the plea, but you can't put the cart before the horse and say, well, I would not have taken it if I'd known a viable defense. Mr. Savage is not a lawyer. And I think
also I'd like you to discuss the cutting off of the GPS as compared with the guidance document that convicted sex offenders on supervision are to follow.
That's fine. I maybe there was there, but the fact of the matter is the agent indicated in her notes that was not something that was an issue with respect to his compliance, whether or not he might.
How could the agent monitor him even if there were phone calls, as you are asserting, even if that were the case, how could the agent monitor him when there was no GPS? So the agent couldn't check whatever he said about his location without the GPS. How would that occur?
That would have been very, very tough. I'll concede that. That would have been very, very tough. But I think the issue goes to the intent to comply. I think that's what the criminal complaint was, the intent to comply. And the agent had indicated in her notes that he had intended to comply. And I think that's what Ms. Dick, as I indicated at the sentencing hearing, was that he was intending to comply, but it was sort of out of his hands. She did not even, it's so funny because she testified differently at the Mockner hearing, talked about the GPS bracelet, but at the sentencing hearing, she specifically focused on the case agent notes that he's intending to comply because he's making these phone calls. He's doing what he's supposed to in that way.
Mr. Rosen, I want to make sure I'm following you. Are you saying that the fact or the evidence that he cut off his GPS would not have been introduced at trial?
It may well have been introduced. I think it probably would have been introduced. I think but the case agent notes, because the case agent, I'm sure, would have testified. She would have had to testify consistent with her notes that she wrote that were introduced at the Mockner hearing, that even though he was intending not to comply with supervision, he was still intending to comply with the SORP. And I think the Court of Appeals had that whole record. They had all the case agent notes. They had everything that was there. They had the transcript that occurred at the Mockner hearing. They had the sentencing transcript, and they still found, after analyzing all this, that my client still had may have had a viable defense under Dinkins to this case, knowing full well that he cut off his bracelet.
If he's saying he wasn't going to be compliant with supervision, he would have been revoked, and he would have been put back into custody, but somehow he was going to stay compliant with registration? I mean, that isn't that a little inconsistent, that argument?
Well, I think that the thing is that the agent indicated that it wasn't. And the agent sort of indicated, I mean, we're here not for the revocation of the underlying criminal case. We're here because of the SORP failure to comply, intend to comply. And that's where we come into the fact, and I can see where the court's coming from. Well, he cuts off the bracelet, but the agent in her notes, and as indicated by Ms. Dick, indicated that told Judge Sanders that he was intending to comply with the SORP requirements. The case notes and the agent split this up. It's not just me. She pointed out, or he pointed out in the case notes, that just because he cut off the bracelet with respect to the DOC supervision does not mean that he did not intend to comply with the SORP requirements and make contact and keep contact with the department. I mean, if the agent had...
Counsel, the relevant question, you know, here is whether, you know, Strickland provides a viable avenue here. So, you know, the trial court made findings. We don't just rely on testimony during a mock and take it at face value. The trial court, you know, made findings of credibility and specifically noted that your client's trial counsel was aware of these things, was aware of this possible defense and determined it didn't apply, or that it wasn't going to be a viable defense. In order to survive deficient performance prong of Strickland, you need to establish that no reasonable counsel who's acting in a minimally competent way, even a bad one, isn't enough, could make that judgment call. Is it your contention that no counsel acting within the zone of minimal competence could have determined the Dinkins defense didn't apply here?
I think a reasonable counsel would have been able to apply that Dinkins would have applied. And
That's a different question.
Okay, maybe I have trouble understanding your question, Your Honor.
It's different to determine whether a reasonable counsel could have made the other decision. But that's not what Strickland, that's not the burden you have. The burden you have to show is that a counsel here acting within some minimal zone of competence, you know, no counsel could have made that kind of judgment call that Dinkins didn't apply, which is a different question than saying a counsel could have made that call.
I think for a counsel not to have made, I'm trying to answer the question as best I can. I think for a counsel to say that Dinkins would not have applied would not have been reasonable under the circumstances. I hope I'm answering your question. I'm just trying to figure this out. If I'm not, please correct me, Your Honor. I'm just trying to figure that out. I think that a reasonable counsel would have applied and indicated that based upon the case notes and based upon the information, as Ms. Dick had told the judge at the sentencing hearing, that Dinkins would have applied. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals concluded based upon that there may have been a viable defense because the trial court had misinterpreted Dinkins. With the impossibility issue. So I think that the Court of Appeals found that a reasonable attorney could have found that it would have applied, whether or not so I think an attorney who would not have said Dinkins would have applied would not have been reasonable. So I hope that answers your question. If not, please let me know. But that's where I think the Court of Appeals basically said, because Dinkins did indicate we need to go back to the Court of Appeal, to the trial court on that issue, because I think the trial court and I know the state wants to say what it wants to, but the trial court did not interpret Dinkins properly, and under the inability and based upon the case notes and based upon Ms. Dick's indication that she never even had discussed Dinkins with the client, that I think that the argument could be made that based upon the case notes and as indicated and would have been evidence at the trial that he did intend to comply with this SORP registration requirements, notwithstanding the cutting off of the bracelet. So I hope that answers your question, Judge. If not, please let me know. I'll try to rephrase it.
Counsel,
I see a smile on Justice Hagedorn's face, so I think he has no further questions in that regard. But to follow up, is it your position that Dinkins was unsettled law in relation to unincarcerated folks, that Dinkins' application to unincarcerated folks was unsettled?
No, it's not unsettled law. I think the Court of Appeals indicated that, and they sort of, when I put in my original appellant's brief that the law was unsettled, it was wrong, and the Court of Appeals rejected it. It's not unsettled law. I mean, I know the facts of Dinkins were that this was a fellow who had gotten out of prison, but still, the fact of the matter is that the court's decision, your decision in Dinkins, applied to inability, and specifically talked about somebody who's living in basements and stairwells and libraries and park benches and that sort of stuff, which clearly does not limit itself to somebody who's just been released from prison and has no place to stay. That it goes broader than that.
Was it your position then in your Court of Appeals brief that Dinkins, as it applied to unincarcerated folks, was unsettled law?
No, it was not my position. It was my position that inability is different than impossibility. And I think that that's what the Court of Appeals also indicated. I know I had a little note there that the law is unsettled and we need further oral argument before the Court of Appeals in my appellant's brief, but the Court of Appeals saw that language and still said that that's not what is going on here. And
I want to focus then on this little argument that you made in your brief. I'm perplexed how you can, on one hand, say that the law is unsettled, and on the other hand, claim deficient performance when it is a bedrock principle that there cannot be deficient performance on a legal issue if the legal issue is unsettled. So how do you reconcile that?
I reconcile it that if I did indicate any claims that Dinkins was unsettled at any point in time, I am withdrawing that position right now. That is what I am simply saying. I am agreeing with the Court of Appeals decision right now in front of all of you that Dinkins is settled law, that it applies to inability, it applies to not to impossibility. I think your decision in Dinkins was about 35 pages from what I recall. You really went into depth in that. And talked about all sorts of examples.
I think it was a great decision, you know, so thank you for that. But I note I think the record indicates that after the Court of Appeals opinion, when you were asking for publication, you were still taking the position that vis-a-vis unincarcerated folks, that Dinkins was unsettled law. But today, that's not your position.
That is not my position.
Okay.
That is not my position. Just for the record, I put that line in my briefs on a fairly steady basis. It's just a standard. But it is not my position that Dinkins is unsettled law. It is my position that the Court of Appeals correctly found that Dinkins is settled law and that it applies to my client, and that Ms. Dick was prejudicially ineffective for not raising that before, because she brought it up before the sentencing hearing at the trial. She brought it up. And I think that that's why the Hill and Dillard talk about that there may have been a viable defense. And I think that under Hill, under Dillard, it doesn't go so far as talks about a reasonable probability. Paragraph of 142 of Dillard, I just looked at it this morning, just quote some Federal Circuit Court federal law that talks about whether or not there's a viable claim of innocence is a grounds for plea withdrawal or an objectively reasonable argument. That's paragraph 142. So I think that under those circumstances, I think basically the Court of Appeals got it right. I think, and you have to go back and analyze the facts. And one thing I think is pretty clear is that the fact analysis that Judge Sanders did at the trial level applied to the argument that we're not raising before the court about the sort of promises that were made. He never talked about, Ms. Dick never denied that she never advised my client of the Dinkins argument that there was there. She just never considered that. And she, and he, my client indicated that had he known about that, that it was viable, he still would have not going to, he was still would have gone to trial. I think, and one thing this, the state is clearly focusing on, well, you know, he got a recommendation of sort of, you know, no more time, but the fact of the matter is he was still facing a large amount of time. And if he goes to trial and he wins because the case agent, those say that, you know, it, cutting off the bracelet is not what was going, is not a factor for the SRRP. Absolute innocence. Anybody wants to be found absolutely innocent as opposed to taking the possibility of getting another felony conviction on your record and possibly taking the risk that you're going to go away for time. And absolute innocence. And that's what he was saying. If I had, and it's, you can't look at these pre-statements because he had no knowledge of it. I mean, he's let's be honest, he's a guy living on, he's not a lawyer. That's why you have a lawyer. That's why Gideon versus Wainwright came about. It, you don't have, you have, that's why you rely upon your lawyer to make the correct decisions in advising you. And that's our position, is that had Ms. Dick done her job and advised him that Dinkins was a viable defense, as the Court of Appeals concluded in this case after having analyzed the full record, he would have gone to trial, and that renders credible his assertions he would have gone to trial, and that therefore there's a sufficient basis for the plea withdrawal under Hill, Dillard, the case law that's before this, relevant and applicable to this court. So that's our position. And I think, once again, that simply because there was a cutting off of the bracelet, under the, when the, you look at the case notes, agents, the case note put together of the agent, that is not swinging the day that, oh, there is no viable defense.
But Mr. Rosen, let me ask about that, because we keep going back to the bracelet being cut off, and this goes back to what Chief Justice Rogensack was asking you at the beginning of your time here. The GPS bracelet wasn't just attached to his supervision under the Department of Corrections. It was because he was homeless, and the Department of Corrections had to come up with some rules to figure out what they were going to do, right, when people were homeless and they had to register on the sex offender registry. And I have what they put out, their administrative directive 15-12, that was put out, I think, at the time, simultaneously with Dinkins, at the time that case was pending in 2015. And one of the things that is on this directive from the Department of Corrections, so that they could continue to monitor people who were supposed to be monitored under the sex offender registry who were homeless, was that they wear a GPS. So you keep talking about the GPS as if it was, would be a condition of his probation. Wasn't the GPS because he was homeless and it was the way that they were still going to monitor him as someone who was supposed to register under the sex offender registry program?
That is what the directive says that came out in 2015. In 2015, it does say that. But what I'm noting is that that directive came out before the case agent notes came out, and she did in, I think it was 2016 or 2017. So that was in the case agent's knowledge that was there, that directive was there. But yet a year after the directive came out that you had quoted, Your Honor, she is still putting out this note, this case note, to another DOC employee that, look, just simply because he cut the bracelet does not mean he did not intend to comply with SRRP notice requirements. I mean, so the fact is that information, and I know it was there in 2015, and whether it was the case agent says, we know about that directive that came out a year before, but we're still saying that he may, you know, there's an issue that he appears to intend to be compliant with the SRRP because he's making those phone calls and trying to get a hold of it.
So, Attorney Rosen, are you saying that all a defendant has to do is make the allegation that they would have withdrawn their plea? I mean, isn't the idea that that there needs to be some kind of corroboration for that? Or are you just saying all he had to do was say, if I had known about this defense, I would not have pled guilty?
Well, I think the corroboration is in the fact that the law, as indicated by the case agent and as indicated by Ms. Dick's statements to the sentencing court, corroborate that that viable defense was there, as found by the Court of Appeals. And also The fact is that, once again, he's not a lawyer, not expected to know that Dinkins is out there and expected to know that Dinkins is prevalent and present. So you can't really put – it's a catch-22 situation for him to say, well, he never knew about Dinkins. That's why you have a lawyer. And that's
what. So it's just enough to say, I would have pled guilty had I known about this defense, despite all the other developments that took place, including at the Mockner hearing, statements that he made, statements that his attorney made. But you're saying it's enough. All we do is look and see, is there a defense and did they know about it? And if they didn't, we let them withdraw their plea. It's ineffective.
Well, I think it's sort of like in the situation with, well, I know there was some pre-hack that he wouldn't have taken the plea in Lee had he known he would have been deported. But the fact of the matter is he didn't, it's you can't say that he would have or not would have done it before, because he had no knowledge that he could had a viable defense to take the that to be innocent under Dinkins, because he had no knowledge of that. So we have to sort of look at the corroboration that he had not been informed of Dinkins before. There had been no knowledge, no information provided to him and so therefore you look at it and say, hey, well, you know what? Even if I would have gotten the time, I still wouldn't have taken the risk or the deal. I still wouldn't have taken the risk because I might have been found innocent of the case. I might have been found innocent and therefore nothing would have happened. So you really, we can look at it now as saying what he would have done. But the fact of the matter is we can't put ourselves in that position because we can't, he didn't know about Dinkins. His attorney didn't, the Court of Appeals found that he didn't know that he could do have that viable defense and therefore assert the right to go to trial.
We do know what the attorney would have said. The attorney would have said, yeah, no, I'm familiar with that, but I'm sorry, you cut off your GPS. You showed that you weren't going to apply. There's no way it's going to work. I don't think you have a shot with that kind of defense. That's basically what the attorney said during the Mockner hearing.
Right, but she told the, first of all, the case note says, as I've gone through about, talks about that even though he had cut off the GPS bracelet, that he still may have had, that it still did not indicate a total, that he still appeared to be intending to be compliant with the SORP. That's the thing the case note said. And that's what Judge Teresa Dick told Judge Sanders at the sentencing hearing. And she can come out and say whatever she wanted to at the Mockner hearing, keep from being found prejudicially ineffective. But she told the Judge Sanders at the sentencing hearing that, and she concurred with what the case agent said. She concurred. She read those case notes to the judge and she said, that's what it appears like is what's going on here, that he is appearing to wanting to be compliant. But he's got, and it appears that he may have just taken the deal, even though he had it just to try to avoid anything without even really knowing what he was getting into by taking the deal, because he hadn't been properly advised.
So also, I think the case notes override everything else. Is the judge supposed to look at nothing but those case notes?
Well, I think that goes to the issue of how a jury would appear and take a prevalence, because I think the case agent would have testified at the trial, and she would have indicated that, yes, I did put it out in there that even though he had cut off the bracelet and even though there's directive, even though all this stuff is, I found that he was intending to be compliant with the SORP registration.
But just because the agent says so doesn't mean that the judge who was finding the facts in this case has to agree with that, right? Because the fact remains that he cut off his GPS bracelet and he was not in contact with his corrections agent, right? And that was required also by the sex offender reporting requirements, right?
From my recollection, yes. But the fact of the matter is, that's not, the Court of Appeals analyzed all that and had all that information and still said there may have been a viable defense. I mean, I think that's what we need to do, is we need to go back to the trial court and look at that in terms of whether or not there's a viable defense. And the Court of Appeals also analyzed all that, analyzed the directive, analyzed what he signed is indicated in the criminal complaint as far as the SORP is concerned, and said, well, he may have had a viable defense because although he did cut off the bracelet, even though that may have been something about the DOC, he still was intending to stay compliant with the SORP requirements based upon his phone calls and the contact he had made. And so, therefore, we're not really looking solely at what the agent says. We're looking at his conduct with respect to to corroborate what the agent said, that he appeared to be intending to be compliant with the SORP requirements. And so, as the Court of Appeals did indicate, it appears that he may have had a viable defense.
So he was intending to remain compliant, but the fact remains that all the evidence indicates he was not, in fact, compliant, right? How not can Higgins give him a defense under those circumstances?
Well, not it as well. We once again, we go back to the case notes where he was in, not intending to be compliant with the DOC supervision, but was intending to be compliant with the SORP requirements to stay in contact with the SORP agent. And I think that's where we come into the fact that there may have been a viable defense, because that's what he was intending to do.
But here we go back in circles again, because the SORP requirements also required him to wear the bracelet and keep in contact with his corrections agent. And it's undisputed that he did not do either of those two things, right?
He did not do either of those two things. No. And I think that comes into basically an interpretation of the what the SORP and what the expert, basically the SORP agent, would testify at trial in terms of the fact that notwithstanding all that, notwithstanding the documentation, notwithstanding what he signed, he still had the intent to stay compliant with the SORP requirements, as she had indicated in the case notes. And I can see where the court is coming from, but that's simply what I think would have come out of trial. And I think that that's something that would have been relevant. And I think that's something, as I've indicated, the Court of Appeals seemed to find relevant. So like you said, we can go around in circles on that, but the fact is that that's what we've got and that's what we had here in terms of that. And I think that was what was testified to us at the mock hearing, but still, notwithstanding all that, we got a Court of Appeals saying, go back and look at everything, trial court. We find that there may be a viable defense here based upon Dinkins. So I also think that once again, under Scholar, we have to look at under Scholar, there was no analysis. The trial court has the opportunity to look at credibility too. And that's one thing that the state seems to forget. They have the opportunity to evaluate body language, tonal intonations, how a person looks, shiftiness of eyes sort of thing, and look into the whites of the eyes to evaluate the credibility of the witness in terms of what happened here. And that's why I think there is no reason to sit there and override or decide Scholar doesn't apply in this situation here, because clearly the Mockner hearing did occur and Judge Sanders did find credibility determinations, but vis-a-vis only with respect to the, he found credibility determination, but he rendered those only in a, as it applied to the issue that is not before this court, about the promises made. He never made any credibility determinations in terms of the fact that, yes, well, Teresa Dick never did discuss Dinkins with him and discuss how Dinkins applied or didn't apply here and discuss the case notes, which she quoted vehemently at the sentencing hearing. And so there was no analysis of the factual need that would occur in a trial court after having looked at a Mockner testimony and looked at the witnesses and how they testified and that sort of thing. And that is why I think that Scholar is applicable here, because then you need to go back to the trial court, go back to Judge Sanders and say, yep, I looked at these people. And based upon this specific issue here, analyzing this under Dinkins, as the Court of Appeals found under the inability standard, that therefore he may or may not have had a viable defense. I mean, all that the Court of Appeals talked about is remanding this thing back to the trial court to do its job because of credibility issues and credibility determinations, which we can't, as this court and many other courts have said, you cannot look at strictly from the four corners of a transcript. That's why it needs to go back to the trial court for that sort of credibility issue. And I think that that's nothing the state has presented, nothing is that the state has indicated indicates that that ruling is inappropriate or inequivocal, inapplicable. Is not appropriate here, that this court should, that this matter should go back to the trial court for its evaluation of credibility, as I've discussed, in terms of the issue as Dinkins, as the Court of Appeals said, with inability. And I think that that's where I think that's where we should rest this. It should go back. I think this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision and leave it at that. don't know if anybody has any more questions. Otherwise, I really have nothing left to say.
Any other questions from the court? Okay, counsel, then we will move on to rebuttal.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Chief Justice. I would really like to draw the court's attention, as I did in my brief at, I believe, page 5 and 6, to the case notes of the specialist. The words that are in the case notes don't exactly say what Mr. Savage thinks they say. The quick timeline is that Mr. Savage was released from prison on March 23rd. On March 22nd, he signed those documents that say, I understand that my sex offender registry requirements also include staying compliant with the DOC, with my agent. In May, the 16th of May, he left a voicemail on the SORP line, and then his agent, there was some emails back and forth, but the emails eventually established that he had already, by May 16th, cut off his GPS and absconded, but he had called on May 16th anyway, so May 5th was when he cut off his GPS and absconded. The notes from the agent on the 19th of May say, sent email to DOC employee, thank you for that information. When did he abscond? Please fill out a 2247 and send to so-and-so within 30 days of the absconding date. Here's the next sentence. Since he reported the address to SORP, it may appear his intent is to remain compliant with SORP and just does not want to be on supervision or follow the rules. This is happening quite a bit, especially with the homeless and who have been through FTR court cases already. So there's a little bit of context there. I won't go beyond the record than what it says, but I suspect that if the case, the specialist who wrote these case notes had been called to testify at trial, the inference from that is, okay, we're seeing this a lot. These sex offenders who think they can cut off, they can, you know, not comply with one and just comply with one, the other, by making phone calls. But the bigger point is, and he also then made one other phone call. So the making phone calls consist of two phone calls, one on May 16th and one on June 17th. And, you know, the question is, why did he stop calling if his intent was to remain compliant? He didn't make any more calls after 6/17 of 2016. He wasn't charged until August. He wasn't arrested on a warrant until February. So he was, the few words, it may appear his intent is to remain compliant with SORP and just does not want to be on supervision or follow the rules. The words that kept getting lifted from that at the sentencing argument and at the Mochner hearing, examination of trial counsel, was his intent is to remain compliant with SORP. And I respectfully disagree with opposing counsel that the agent, the specialist who wrote this, represented that his intent was to remain compliant. What she said was, it may appear his intent is to remain compliant with SORP, but he doesn't want to follow the rules. So I don't think that these case notes go anywhere near helping Mr. Savage at trial. And I would like to say, too, that the other point, part of the record to point to is, you know, page one of the criminal complaint says that he knowingly failed to comply with the reporting requirements under 301.45.2-4. And the the probable cause portion of the complaint says that attached is our sex offender registration form part two. According to the information on this form, the specialist did explain to the defendant his duty to register, comma, registration requirements regarding changes and that failure to comply or provide false information could result in criminal prosecution. So I'm sorry, I see my time is up.
No, that's fine. You were reading and you were doing just fine. So, well, thank you both for interesting oral arguments. We are going to take a break now while we change over to our second case of the day. Thank you very much.